Okay, we are now recording on the audio. I'm going to do a mute all, and you will all have the ability to unmute yourself if you wanted to chime in with a question or comment. By all means, do so, or we'll try and monitor the chat, and you can do it that way as well. So with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris, and welcome, everyone. We have a whole raft of stuff tonight, so we're going to start right off with a follow-up from a question last week. And, Chris, if you look to you.
Yeah, it's, we had some discussion on digitizing film and slides and negatives. And it just happens that, well, first off, I say that the best might still be to use the Ottawa Public Library's digitization lab at Beaverbrook. And I think there's another branch that has a digitization lab as well. But I just happened across a video that's available through YouTube from Hudson Henry, who's a photographer out in Oregon. And it was how to easily digitize film. And the easily, I should probably have put in quotes, that's the title of the video, but how easy it is, I'm not exactly sure after having watched it. But he does go into some detail about it, and he talked at length about how it was the best approach that he had done. He's a gearhead, so he has tried all kinds of digitizers and things like that, and it's the method that he's found to be very, very good. It requires a pretty modern camera and a little bit of extra gear. He can probably do it without a lot of that extra gear, but he goes through a whole bunch that you can use to get really good results on digitization. So there's that one. And then at, he runs a weekly or biweekly office hours webinar that's available to everybody. And at this week's office hours, which was just yesterday, they did talk a little bit about, as follow-up to that, how to digitize film, some other equipment that you can use and other techniques and so forth. So it's about an hour long, I believe it is, office hours. And so the part that is talking about the digitizing starts at 1740, if you want to skip all of the other photographic stuff in there. So if anybody's looking to digitize, there's a couple of other things you can look into.
Thanks, Chris. And the next item we have, I actually put a note in the members forum a little while ago about this class action settlement. It's been on the news, on the national news on television quite recently. But I think Chris, again, has some words of wisdom.
Yeah, I was actually, I followed up with this or looked into it a little bit a while ago, and I sort of poo-pooed it a little bit. And then, yes, it did hit CBC News in particular. They have an email that goes out, and it was on their homepage for CBC News about it yesterday or the day before. So I looked into it a little bit more, and turns out if you bought, it actually includes MS-DOS, Windows, Office, Word, or Excel, and I believe the other Office individual standalone Office applications are available as well. Anywhere between December 23rd, 1998 through March 11th, 2010, so it's over 11 years period, you can get up to $250 cash back for individual licenses. You can actually get more if you did volume licensing, and you can get more if you have proof of purchase. So this is up to $250 without any proof of purchases. And so it varies, I think, from, I forget what the exact numbers are. I think Windows, copy of Windows license is like $13 and or a little bit more than that. I think Office licenses you can get $13 for and things like that. So you just go to that website, fill it in, and you'll be put into the queue, and you will get yourself a check. And so this includes copies of Windows and Office that are pre-installed on computers that you bought. So if anybody bought a computer, a Windows computer in that period, you have at least the Windows license that you should be able to get some money from. And so take a look, and if you want to, it'll be about 2 years before you actually see any money, but they will start paying out early 2022.
And Stefan says he's already put his claim in for $52.
Very good.
Okay, so we'll let everybody look up their purchases and see how much you can claim.
And Chris, unfortunately, during that time period, I was quite proud of the fact I didn't have a single paid-for Microsoft license on any of my machines. And now that all my licenses are properly up to date, that's after that time period. So I think I'm out of luck on this one.
Well, I figured on this one, like I bought two or three computers in that time frame, and they all would have come with a copy of Windows on them. I didn't buy any as bare computers. So, you know, I can definitely go in and put in a claim.
And it'll be such a surprise when you get the check because you've forgotten all about it, like all of 2021.
Yeah, exactly.
So enjoy, everyone. Okay, the next item is, it says share, but it's also kind of a follow-up, as we'll see in a minute. Chris mentioned that we're recording the session tonight, and we have been recording the sessions for quite a while now. And we are posting the PowerPoint file and the associated audio recording, and also a text file with the contents of the chat window. And if you go to our Q&A page, web page, you'll find that the most recent Q&A session is listed there with all the various files that you can download. However, we also have all of the recordings that we've made available on a slightly different page, which is QA Recordings. So here's a bunch of files from the October 2020 period, for example. So it's possible to go back in time and see what we've done. And we have an index to these recordings. So there's an index of topics, and it's basically a text file. And then there's a link back to the week, the date on which any given recording was produced. So here's the kind of follow-up bit of it. Last week, I think, somebody was asking about a replacement or a battery that was failing in the laptop. And I had mentioned that we'd had this discussion about replacement laptop batteries some time ago. But of course, at the time, I couldn't remember exactly what the context was or when it happened. But by going to the topics page, you can actually search. So you could use the search box on the home page, and it will get you to any keyword that Google robots have already listed. But if you go to the actual topics page, then you can search that page by using Control F, which will pop up a search window. And so here I typed in battery, and it turns out there are two instances of the word battery on this page. And when you scroll down, you can find that on August the 5th, we had a segment on replacement laptop batteries. So if I were to download that PowerPoint file and the audio file, I could find out exactly what we were talking about and the various links that people referred to as good sources for replacement laptop batteries. So there you have it. What we're doing tonight will be on the website by tomorrow morning at the latest. And now we have a share from Chris about fonts. And I think you're going to take over the...
Yes, I'm going to. And I... Let me just... when you know what I do... Oh, I do have the right deck loaded. Okay. Yes, I will take over screen share. And ding. Yes. And screen. Okay, so I came across this site recently, dafont.com, and it's kind of interesting. They've got over 50,000 fonts available in 72 categories. They are free and paid, and I'll talk a little bit more as I go through about how to find out what the licensing is on various fonts, but there are lots available that are free. There are a huge number of categories of groupings. You can check the licensing, and you can just, there are some other techniques. And rather than bore you with death by PowerPoint, what I'll do is I will just go to the site. If I can find it, where am I here? Too many things open. Okay, so here's DefFont. This is their home site, home page. And you can see in the middle section here, they have a whole bunch of different categories of fonts. So you can go and you can just browse around and things like that, but I do suggest that the easiest way is to find a category that seems to make sense for what you're looking for. So, for example, if I'm looking for a basic sans serif font, I can just click on here, and now it has narrowed it down to there are 25 fonts per page, and there are 89 pages of basic sans serif fonts. So, and you can scroll down, and you can see various things about them. You can see examples. You can actually type in your text here, and so I could type in OPCUG and submit, and then it will actually show the font with the text that I've actually typed in. Now, that's too many to go through, so what I would suggest you start with is by going to the More Options and go 100% free and submit. And then you'll see now we've brought it down to 26 pages at 25 fonts per page, so 250, I guess, fonts that are 100% free, and you can go through and you can look at the various fonts. Now, once you get to a font that you think, oh, that looks kind of interesting, you can look, and I've got things covering up stuff here with Zoom, but okay, so if we were to look at Beba's new, there are two font files, and it says it's public domain, and it's been downloaded over 17 million times, over 7,000 times just yesterday. Now, I can click on the word here, and it'll give me some additional details about that particular font. So there's notes from the author, and, you know, it tells you it has lowercase and italics, and tells you if you're using Adobe Fonts, what you have to do for it, and so forth. And then it'll come down, and it shows you some of the character set that is available. So here we can see that, oh, this is an interesting font because it's the lowercase letters are capitals. So you don't have any true lowercase letters. You have small caps. And then we come down and we have some of the symbols and so forth. Looks like they've built in all of the main accented characters and so forth into the font. So it gives you a little bit more detail about it. And they will usually tell you a little bit more about licensing if you're not in 100% free. They'll give you a little bit of information about how you can legally use that particular font. Now, let me go to a particular font that I thought was kind of interesting. So I'm going to search on Roboto. And Roboto is an interesting font. It was actually designed by Google to be their system font in about 2011. And it's specifically designed to work on small text, on small screens, and so forth. So a lot of people put down Roboto, but for what it was designed for, it's actually pretty good. They actually have 16 font files built into here. If I click on this and get it, then I have right from thin, thin italic, light, regular. I have medium. I have bold, extra bold. I have condensed fonts. So there's a lot of font files that are actually available on here. Again, because it's from Google, it's 100% free, and so there's no licensing issues or anything like that on it. Let me look at a couple of other interesting fonts that I happened across. So if I look at Snowy Christmas, and this was a font that it's free for personal use. Okay, so you have to be a little bit more careful when it comes to free for personal use. But if I come in here and click on the font, it gives me a little bit more information about it. So please contact me for commercial use. So it's only free for personal project, nonprofit, and charity use. Okay, so if you're making money from it, he expects you to buy a license from him. Now, interestingly, if we look at this, it has these special characters that are available in it. And he tells you up in here, if you type open parentheses, you get the opening splash. If you type close parentheses, you get the ending splash. And if you type a greater than sign, you get the snowman. Okay. And if you look down in the character set, you can see that that's how it is. If you have the open parentheses, it'll actually give you that, that special character, right there. So the open and close. And there's, if you print, type in the greater than sign, you'll actually get a snowman. Note that if you put in a less than sign, you get nothing. There is no character that is built into that character space. So it is very much a specialized font. But if you're doing something like a Christmas card or something like that, you get these little snowflakes and that on all of the letters, and you get a snowman, and you get those extra splash characters. So kind of an interesting font in that. And then I'm going to show one other one. So if we do cotton candies and do a search on this, and let's go click on the font. And again, free for commercial, for personal use. If you have a commercial, you can buy a license for the font. This is an interesting one, and it has these extra flourish on some of the letters that will go underneath the letters, or, you know, beyond where the letter would normally end. And so that's kind of cool. And if you go down here, you can see how the character set has been built. But I don't see any of those flourishes anywhere. Okay. So if I want to actually use those, I had to actually find, well, where are they in the character set? I actually did install the fonts on my computer. And if I come to character map, and if I go to cotton candy, okay, I see the entire character set in here, including if I go down here, I see those extra flourishes in the character set. So if I wanted to actually use those, the easiest way to do it is through character map. So if I bring up a copy of, well, let's just do it in our, actually I'll do it on my deck. So, sorry about that. Okay, so if I just come in here and I decide that I wanted to insert some, oh, I missed something. Okay, so if I want to insert and some text, and text box, if I just type in Christmas or something like that, and then I go to that particular box, and I choose Snowy Christmas.
You've lost your screen share, Chris.
Oh, did you? Okay, sorry. Screen share. Screen share. Are you back?
Yes, now.
Okay. So if I take that text box, and then I come here, and I go to cotton candies. Whoop. Cotton candies. And so now I have, let's make this bigger. And let me also bring that up. Okay. So if I want a special character like that, the easiest way for me to get it is actually come into character map, get the character that I actually want with the flourish on the end of it. So say I wanted a Y, you know, that goes out like that. I can say select and copy, and then I would come into here. And if I do a Y just like that, I get a regular Y. But now if I paste from the clipboard, I get the special Y, which if I you see now that I've got that extra flourish on that character set. So there are some special characters that you can get at that website that will actually give you those, you know, unusual sort of characters in the character set. So kind of interesting. The other thing I wanted to show, if I come back to the homepage, they do have instructions on here on how to install a font. And it tells you that you just download the font file, and then you go to, in Windows, you right-click on it, and you choose Install. If you do that, just be aware of the fact that it will install it for you personally only. So if I come down to here, so here I've got a whole bunch of font files if I right-click on it, I can choose install. That will install it for just my account. So if somebody else is logged onto my computer, they will not see that font. If you go to install for all users, you see that you get that shield, which is the user account protection, and it'll ask you if you want to do this as an administrator. If you do that, it installs it under C:\Windows\Fonts, and then it'll be available to all users. So just be aware of that when you're doing the installation, whether you want it personal or whether you want it installed for all users. And I think, let me just see if I had anything else to say about that. Where is my, thought I had the deck loaded. Defont. Oh, that's the wrong deck, sorry. Actually, it'll work. I don't think that I really had a lot of extra information, but let me just flip through this just to make sure that I'm not missing something. Oh, yes. Yeah, this is actually important, too. If you use one of these fonts and you give that document to somebody else, you could have a problem, because what's the likelihood that somebody else is going to have Cotton Candies installed on their computer? So if I create a document, I have Cotton Candies installed, and it shows up on screen correctly. If I give that document to somebody else and they don't have it installed, this is likely what they're going to see. So there will be a font substitution happens, which will be somewhat random. It'll still say that it's Cotton Candies, so I guess if the person knows that they're not getting the right font, they could go look for a font called Cotton Candies. But not only do they just get the regular characters, that extra flourish Y, it was part of the character set that the whatever got substituted had nothing there. And so you can run into problems like that. If you have that problem, or want to avoid that problem, what you can do is embed the font in your document. So in Microsoft Office products, they all work the same way. Basically, you go to the file menu, you go to options, and then under the save section, you choose the option to embed fonts. And you can embed just the fonts that were actually used in the document, in which case they could see it, but if they tried to, you know, add additional characters that were not already used, you know, they wouldn't be able to. So I usually say embed the entire font so they could actually edit it and add. It won't install the font on their computer, but it will show up in the document. And you can choose to have it do this embedding of the fonts in the current document, or you can go to the drop-down list and choose all documents. Then I ran into another interesting one, a license restriction. There was one of the fonts that I was playing around with, Snowy Christmas, that had that flourishes and then the snowman. And it was free for personal use. But if I tried to save the document with embedding fonts, this dialog popped up saying save with fonts. It cannot be saved because there is a license restriction on that particular font. So even though it was free for personal use, the person tagged it such that it can't be embedded in a document. So my only recourse in that case was that I had to go and change away from that document from using that particular font before I could actually save it. Okay, so just something to watch out for in the license restrictions that you might run across. I think that was it. Yep. So any questions about that particular site?
A couple of comments, I think. Bob Harris says the font could be used very quickly and easily with a screenshot using something like Snagit or Greenshot.
Yeah, you can. But to me, it's really awkward to end up doing that because it's no longer an editable thing. And if you change its size, it doesn't necessarily scale very well. Whereas if it's a TrueType or an OpenType font, you know, you can scale it to any size you want, and it'll maintain its characteristics properly and so forth.
Well, he agrees with you now. He says, wow, installing the font sounds powerful. And actually, I was thinking his idea is good if it's just like a single heading, then you could embed it as a graphic and not really yep. worry about it. And in fact, I ran into that problem with your deck because in the when I imported the deck into tonight's deck, and the fonts didn't come across, of course.
Yeah.
So what I did was I took screenshots of your deck and dropped the images into my deck. So when I load the PDF on the website, people will see what you intended, but of course it won't be editable. It's a PDF file anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
The other way you could have done it is taken my deck and then just dumped all your content into it.
True, I could have done that. But I told it to retain the source, but of course it still didn't retain the source because it doesn't have the font, I guess.
Yeah.
And Justin has a comment. If you have a font that you'd like to identify, you can try a website called identifont.com. And the link for that is in the chat window.
Cool. And just as a final comment on that, did we have any other questions?
Yeah, Lawrence is saying, from an organizational commercial perspective, using non-standard or typical Windows Mac fonts causes printing and other issues, can lead to some uncomfortable questions / answers.
Yeah. I mean, that's par for the course. Printing shouldn't be a problem from the person who has the font installed on their computer. But, of course, if you're going to be circulating documents around, you're best to stick with the standard fonts that come with Windows and possibly Office. Office installs a whole whack of extra fonts as well. And so sticking with one of those is definitely going to save you a lot of grief.
Or, as I've discovered, you get someone who's built a really nice PowerPoint presentation and then stores it on a USB key because they can't use their computer at the conference center, and their PowerPoint presentation comes up, and, oh, the fonts look absolutely terrible.
Yeah. And usually they don't look terrible. They've just been substituted with something else.
I mean, when I say terrible, the person's like, oh, my Lord, how did that happen? And then, you know, there's some, as I say, there's some very, oh, it's got to be your equipment. And then you ask, okay, what type of fonts do you use? Oh, I've downloaded these spectacular fonts. Well, that's great, but we don't have the license to use them. If you print it, great. Now, I don't even know. Do you know if PDFs are affected by the same issue or not? That's what I was trying to remember.
Shouldn't be. Well, actually, that's interesting. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. I mean, the idea is that, if you have an image, you're good. I mean, if you're sending out an image, but, how many times is that done versus doing a PDF or a Word document, which is considered to be standard?
Yeah. Now, I am going to be giving a presentation in the spring on typography, and I'm going to have this warning in one of my first slides for sure. I am not a font expert, as is evident by the fact that I would use such a font. If you're interested in learning more about typography, it's actually a very fascinating, I find it very fascinating. It's a very deep subject, so I'll be covering it about ankle deep, in the spring at one of the main meetings of the PC user group, I will be talking about typography.
By then, of course, you'll know the difference between a typeface and a font.
I already know that difference. Yes, I've been starting reading a lot. There's a ton of really, really good information.
I don't think this is a font knows the difference. But never mind. There's another question here. I'm glad. Okay. Are all of those free fonts not embeddable?
A lot of them are embeddable. That was fine. The Cotton Candies one, which was free for personal use, was also embeddable. So there was no problem with that. The Snowy Christmas was the only one that I ran across that was not embeddable, but there are a lot. I haven't looked at an awful lot of the fonts that are there. And certainly if you're interested in spending the money for it, anything that is not embeddable, I would be willing to bet that there's somebody who's willing to sell you a version of the font that is embeddable, if you're willing to pay some money for it.
Are there apps available to remove the digital rights management on fonts?
There are font editors which presumably would allow you to do that. That's one of the things that I'm going to cover a little bit in the spring presentation is if you're interested in font design, there are a number of open source font editors that presumably allow you to do something about the embeddability and things like that. But I haven't played around with them yet, so, and I don't know that I'll play around with them an awful lot, but I will look into that a little bit.
Well, that is saying, to print to Google Drive from Chrome, we will soon have to save from Print Preview. Google says that you have to make sure backup and sync or Drive file stream is installed. I can't find either available in Play. Would I have to use an alternative?
They're not in Play. If you go to drive.google.com, you can install the backup and sync or the newer file stream, drive stream, whatever it is they call it.
Yeah, drive file stream, I think.
Drive file stream. So they are available at drive.google.com.
And that's it, Chris.
Okay, I will stop share and turn it back over to you.
Okay, so I will share and... Okay, so now we're moving on to a smart app. And my smart app this week comes from a lot of chat on the OPCUG user forum about how to send text messages from PCs to smartphones. And I think this largely came about because the person who wanted to send a text had problem typing on the tiny little keyboard of the smartphone. And my solution to that is to switch the default keyboard, the Android keyboard, to Google keyboard. Because Google keyboard offers you a very interesting way of typing. So it's a replacement keyboard that's got a whole bunch of different features. One of the ways it does it is, I think Chris sometimes uses this, maybe called Swift typing or something like that. Glide typing. So you can type on a keyboard, but instead of hitting the individual keys, you slide your finger from letter to letter, and it uses kind of perspective determination what the word is that you're trying to type, and offers you that as an option to select. Yeah, they also say that Google Keyboard will do handwriting recognition, so you can write cursive and printed letters. I find this hard to believe on a tiny little smartphone that I would want to do cursive writing, but maybe on an Android tablet, if you had a pen, a
stylus, usually.
Stylus, right. If you had a stylus that you could actually write with, then, you know, that might be an option. Some interesting things it does, if you have multiple languages enabled on your Android device, you can do multilingual typing, and it will autocorrect and suggest the correct words based on the language that you're using. And they also say it will translate. So if you're abroad somewhere, you could type a sentence in English and have your Italian waiter understand what you're trying to say, I guess, in Italian. And then for those of you who are in love with images, they say it has a fast emoji search and also a way to search for images in GIF format. But the way I use it is saving the best to the last. It allows voice typing, so it essentially allows dictation. So you can see here on the keyboard that there's a little microphone icon, and that microphone icon has been touched, and now the device is listening for somebody to speak, and it will do voice to text. So, for example, here is my K9 email client, and interesting enough, it doesn't accept voice typing in the to field. So I still have to type like CHR, and then it will decide I want to send a message to somebody like Chris Taylor, so I can kind of select that. But then once I've got to fields that it will accept, so for example, like here we're in the message, and I've enabled the microphone. You can see that in the middle of the screen there, it says speak now. So I'm in the midst of dictating, and I'm saying, Chris, I just gave it the command for A, and now you've got this problem that how do you tell it that you want a new line? So I tried things like new line, and then you get for a new line, and then I tried for a new line, new line. And something like that does the trick, but I haven't quite figured out how it all works, because the next line I try was, why does new line work when new line gives me a new line? And you can see that two of them, it's shown the text, and the middle one, it actually did give me a new line. Usually the punctuation is simple. You want period or comma or something like that. And you literally say, gives me a new line, period. And then you're off to the races. I find it a really useful way to do short SMS text messages, for example. Rather than have to struggle with this tiny little keyboard, I can just dictate my one-line message or two-line message to somebody and then just press return and the thing's gone. It's a really neat toy. So if anybody's interested in doing that, I highly recommend you download it. You don't lose anything. You've got a regular keyboard there. But you get all these neat toys to play with at the same time. I leave that for you to think about. And in the meantime, we'll move on, and Chris has another share all about electronic voting.
Yeah, this was came out of it was linked to this cartoon from an article that I'm going to talk more about. But basically, the cartoon starts off with, if you look at aircraft designers and they're talking about safety, you know, they say that, you know, nothing is foolproof, but, you know, they're very safe to travel by air. And if you ask a building engineer about elevator safety, they'll say how, you know, there's multiple fail safes on it and they're tried and true and, you know, they're nearly incapable of falling. And if you ask a software engineer about computerized voting, they say that's terrifying. And if questioned like, really? They say, don't trust voting software. Don't listen to anybody who tells you it's safe. And don't know how quite to put this, but our entire field is bad at what we do. If you rely on us, everyone will die. And then they bring up blockchain. And I think everybody here probably knows a little bit about blockchain. It's technology behind cryptocurrencies to ensure its integrity. And so everybody thought, oh, integrity, then must be good for voting then. And so, you know, they said, we'll fix it with something called blockchain. Whoever sold it to you, don't touch it, bury it in the desert, wear gloves. So a little bit of a cartoon about this next slide. So Bruce Schneier is a security guru, extremely well known. He's a cryptographer, very, very bright, world renowned. And in his latest newsletter, he had a quote in there where he says, blockchain voting is a spectacularly dumb idea for a whole bunch of reasons. And a couple that he talks about, he says, first off, it doesn't solve any problems that elections currently have. It's incompatible with software independence. And in the context of electronic voting, software independence would be that even if the software was compromised or attacked or anything like that, you could still determine the correct outcome. And so blockchain is incompatible with that. And it actually makes ballot secrecy difficult or impossible because blockchain inherently has to identify all of the things that go on throughout it. If you're interested in reading more about it, I include the link there for the latest cryptogram. And that particular article is anchored in it. So if you want to read a little bit more, if somebody has been trying to tell you that blockchain is going to be the solution for all electronic voting moving forward, it probably isn't.
Okay, so our next share is about updating software. And again, Chris has a bunch of thoughts on this.
Yeah, I came across this, stumbled across it myself just recently. And so if software updates come available, a lot of people, you know, have told me, oh, I don't want to do updates because my computer's working well. And I've heard that, you know, if people install updates, all of a sudden their computer won't boot or the software will start failing and things like that. And it's true because a lot of the updates, if we go back to that cartoon, you know, the reality is that software is far from perfect. And so something could go wrong on your computer. But if updates become available, first off, I say if it's security related, yes, update. Okay, because they're fixing something that if left unfixed, somebody may be able to use to compromise your computer, your data, your identity, and so forth. So I say if a security update comes out, do the update. If it's not security related, check to see the list of the fixes that are in that particular update. And most vendors, when they do come out with an update, they will actually tell you that here's the list of things that we've changed in it. Now, sometimes at the end, they'll put a catch-all of saying other bug fixes and so forth. But in the next slide, we'll see what I came across. So EaseUS to Do Backup is the backup program that I use. Years ago, I was trying to set up a backup task that excluded certain things from the backup. So it would make the backup smaller. So I wanted to exclude things like the paging and the hibernation file, which on my computer are about 18 gigabytes. The Windows index, which on my computer is about 1 gigabyte. I use ON1 Photo RAW. Its caches are about 4 gigabytes. Browser caches, temp files, and so forth, 12 gigabytes. So if I could exclude 35 gigabytes from my backups, that would save me a lot of room on my backup drive. Unfortunately, there was a problem with it that if I excluded those, did any file exclusions, I got weird failures. And I tried contacting EaseUS support. They were very polite and so forth. They asked me for more details. They asked me for log files. They asked me, you know, to try recreating tasks and things like that. Nothing ever fixed it. They never acknowledged that there was actually a problem or that, you know, anything was going to be fixed. So what I did was I just continued using the program, which was fine, as long as I didn't exclude files. Next slide.
Good to get there.
And so an update came out just a couple of days ago, and one of the changes was it said adopt a new method of excluding files during backup. And they claimed it greatly improves backup performance and reduces backup space occupation. And I think, I wonder if they actually fixed the problem that I had years ago where file exclusions didn't work for me. So I created a new backup task to exclude the files that I didn't want, like the paging file and things like that. And sure enough, it worked. And so my advice is don't ignore updates. If it's security, apply it. If it's non-security, take a look and see if it fixes anything that maybe you want fixed in your version of the software.
Okay, there's a question here from Micheline, which I just misunderstood. My main problem with updates, and she's talking about Windows updates, I guess, is that they occur when I'm in the middle of something and the computer decides to reboot. How do I stop it doing this? When they offer to update at different times, this never works for me. One of the things I do is to tell it that I'm on a metered connection, and then it doesn't update until I tell it it can. You have any other thoughts, Chris?
I've never had a problem where it rebooted by itself. I do set I forget what they call it now.
Where active time period.
Yeah, active time periods. So I make sure that you can only set it to, I think, 18 hours a day, but you can tell it that there's certain periods of the day that it's not allowed to do any reboots. And I've always had it pop up with saying, you know, a reboot is required, and click here to reboot or click here to schedule it. And that always worked reliably for me.
And Peggy says, how can I find out what the computer wants to update?
With Microsoft it's difficult. There's they will just tell you, you know, we're going to apply a whole bunch of updates. You can go onto their website, and there is a page where they actually detail everything that they – well, everything. Everything they want to talk publicly about, they do detail what has been changed. But the problem that I find of even worrying about that is that the Microsoft updates are monolithic. They are one thing. You can't say, oh, I want this fix, but I don't want this fix. And there is always going to be security fixes in it. So I always have to apply it. And so do I really care what's changing in it? Not really. You know, so I just go and say, yeah, update everything. And I just live with consequences of that.
Stuart says, if Microsoft was a political party, updates would be called omnibuses.
Yes.
And my answer, as I keep telling everyone, is to use Linux. Because if you use Linux, you get a list of updates. They're all checkmarked. You can uncheck any update. You can uncheck them all if you want. And you can do what you want when you want.
Yeah.
And that's the way Microsoft should do it.
That's the way every software company should do it, but I understand where Microsoft is coming from. If they provide that level of information, some people would throw up their hands and never install any updates. So, you know, they're a little bit caught between a rock and a hard place. You know, they want to make it easy for people. They do want to give people flexibility, but if they give too much flexibility, it creates chaos in itself. So, yeah, I sort of see both sides of the coin.
So that's why on my Windows box, I basically hedge and I tell it I'm using a metered connection, which means that I might have to pay for lots and lots of downloads. So by doing that, they won't force the updates on me until I tell it it's okay to do so.
Yeah, and it used to be that metered connections only worked on Wi-Fi connections, but you can now do metered connections on wired connections as well. So you can certainly use that trick to prevent them from pushing updates to you. But be careful if you do that, because there are a lot of security issues that come up. And so you do want to apply those updates, but at least this, you can do it at your own time frame. You can also go to their website, find out what changes there are. You can also wait a week to see if anybody else is complaining about a bad update, things like that. So it's definitely a way to do it. But if you do that, please be sure to manually apply the updates at some point.
Yeah, and that's very important, because one of the things that stops are updates to Windows Defender, which come typically twice a day. So,
oh, they come about 10 times a day, typically.
Do they? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a note here, there's some of the security and maintenance suites, like Avast, will identify which of your programs aren't up to date. And that's a good thing to have. But the flip side is, if you click on it, they'll try and update it for you remotely. And that's not a good thing to do. Once they identify what needs to be updated, it's much better to do it yourself manually on a application by application basis. Because I've tried having them do the automatic thing, and it's inevitably going to end up as a mess.
Good to know.
So Michelin says, I'm running Windows 7, which has no security updates. Is it okay to leave updates switched off?
Well, it doesn't really matter, because you're not getting updates for Windows 7. Microsoft ended updates for that years ago. So,
and so switch to Linux. Okay, moving along. A couple of questions. This is from Bob Walker. I've used email clients that allow you to sort messages into directories and subdirectories, or folders, whatever you want to call them. Now, Gmail doesn't allow this, but they have labels instead. How do I use labels to sort and categorize my email messages? And then he has a second question, which is unrelated, but it basically says, when I'm sharing my, he's thinking about being a presenter on a Zoom video conference. When I'm sharing my screen, my microphone sends anything I say to other participants. If I'm playing a video or a pre-recorded PowerPoint presentation, does the audio also get sent to the other participants? So he's thinking along the lines of, if we ever go back to real monthly meetings, like in-person monthly meetings, and we have a presenter, I guess, can we also send it out by Zoom or something along those lines? Anyway, I thought we might be able to kind of kill two birds with one stone, as they say, or two birds with one video in this case. I had exactly the question about Gmail labels from a friend of mine just a week or so ago. And one of the things I did, instead of trying to send a long email, or sometimes I'll actually use TeamViewer and do a remote control type session to show people how to do things. In this case, I actually used a screen grabber to create a video which kind of talked a little bit about Gmail labels. So I've got the answer as a short video. The question is, can we also answer Bob's second question and play this in this Zoom video conference, and what's going to happen? So we're going to try that and find out. So here we go. So here's my video. So I created it as an MKV file because I created it in Linux. But I've switched it to an MP4 file, which I think everybody can probably play. So it's going to be loaded into VLC as a video player. So let's just see what happens when I try and play this video. Gmail inbox. If I go over to the left side menu and choose more, and then scroll down, I can. So what's happening out there? It's working for me here.
It sounds good here.
Okay, well let's let it run then.
The button here, create a new label. So I'll do that, and I'll call the new label blog. And I'll create that. So if I now scroll back up this list, I now have a new entry called blog. So if I go and select Bridget's message here about blogs and this message about blogs, then I can go to this icon which says move to, and I can choose to move it to my blog label. But I could also choose, say, this blurred message right here, and I could choose to just drag it over and drop it in blog. And you can probably see that they've now gone from this list. So if I open blogs, there are my labels. That's basically how you use labels in Gmail.
There's one comment that Natalie had that the sound was a little muted, and it was for me as well, but I mean, it does play. If you're going to do that, you might want to check a little bit into volumes and things like that. But overall, it does actually work. So.
Okay. Well, I had a backup, and my backup is in these slides right here. So it's basically saying if you go to the Gmail inbox and then pick up this menu on the left-hand side, if you scroll down to the More menu and then scroll down that list, right at the bottom you'll find something that says Create New Label. And when you hit that, it pops up a box, and you can select any word, any phrase, whatever you want to label this folder. It's not really a folder. It really is just a label which Gmail tags your messages with. So we create one called blog, I guess, or blogs or something. So now I've gone and I've checked a couple of messages up here by selecting the checkboxes. And then I go up to the Move To icon. And when I select that, it lets me choose the blogs, and I save it there. Or I can left click on a message here, hold the mouse down, and then drag it across and drop it onto the blog's label. And then once I've done that, I look in blogs. Sometimes I find that the blog is now empty and my messages have gone from the inbox. But when I log out of Gmail and log back in again, this is what I see, that blogs now have the correct messages inside them. And what you'll find is that you can actually give, they're not really folders. Like in Thunderbird, you actually have a real folder and you drag the message from the inbox into a blog's folder. In Gmail, you really just tag the message with a blog's label. And you can tag it with a website label, and you can tag it with a pretty flowers label. And that same message will show up in the different folders because it has these different labels attached to it. So that's how Gmail labels work, as opposed to regular folders.
Yeah, I think Alan and I were discussing this a little bit, and I think fundamentally Gmail doesn't have any folders at all. There's no inbox folder, sent items folder. They're not separate folders. They're just all tags on individual messages. And, for example, if you, from your Gmail account, if you send a mail to, say, somebody else and CC yourself, and what you'll end up seeing is that it'll be in the sent item, or it'll be in the sent items, but it'll be tagged, and you'll see it actually in the message line. It'll say inbox. And so, you know, and you go to the inbox, and sure enough, it shows up there. It's really just one message. You know, there, it's just been tagged as being this sent item is then tagged with inbox. So it shows up in your inbox as well. So it's sort of a bizarre thing to get used to, but just think of it as tags as opposed to folders.
Okay, so a couple of people were saying that the sound was very muted, and my apologies for that, but I didn't do anything special. I just have a laptop here that has a built-in microphone, and I've got speakers plugged into it. So I'm playing the video, and the microphone is picking up the sound from my speakers, and I'm just amazed that I didn't get tons of feedback, but there you go.
I was just going to say that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to swap out you vocalizing towards the microphone with another source, and you know, you could compensate for that by upping the speakers, the volume on the speakers when you were playing that back. And that may have worked. The other thing that I find that works is that if you happen to have external speakers on other monitors, you can direct the output from the monitor speaker, which is more likely to be picked up by the laptop microphone. So it's you're playing with input output and making sure that you can pick up that the analog signal, for lack of a better term, from one to the other.
As I said, I didn't do anything special, Lawrence. I just the speakers I hear and the microphones on the laptop, and have a nice day. I cranked up the volume on the video, but clearly not that wasn't enough to do the trick. Michelin's asking, when you export tagged emails to another email client, do the tags remain attached? I don't know, but my guess is no. Anybody have any ideas on that one? Don't all yell at once. Claudette says, I sign into my PC using an Outlook address. Is it best to only use Google from the browser in that case, rather than use Outlook? I tend to use Chrome most of the time.
Well, the sign into the PC is totally separate. So don't think of it that as being your Outlook email or anything like that. It's just it's completely, completely separate. So how you deal with mail is entirely different thing. So if you use Outlook currently as your email client, That's fine. It's just doing a POP or IMAP connection to your Google account. So you can use either the browser and access your Gmail from there, or you can use your Outlook. Both of them are just using different methods of accessing your Gmail account, but it's totally separate from your login to your PC.
Okay, so our next question is about upgrades again. This time I'm using Windows 8, actually 8.1, but haven't changed to Windows 10. Should I move sooner rather than later from 8.1 to 10? And Chris has the
answer. Of course. Well, Windows 8.1, it reached the end of mainstream support in 2018. Mainstream support means that they will fix any bugs that happen to come out. They might change functionality in the program, whatever, as well as security updates. After the first 5 years, they switched to extended support. In extended support, they only promise to fix security issues. So extended support continues till January 10th, 2023. So From my point of view, I mean, the likelihood of major bugs outside of security issues that I'm interested in an operating system, probably not going to be very many that occur after 5 years. So I'm mostly interested in making sure that it's secure. And so from that point of view, you know, I don't think you have to worry about it until January 2023. So you got a while to go on that. Eventually, you will get to, if you keep on 8.1, if you go past that date, then you're no longer going to get any security-related fixes. If you continue to follow other security-related advice on, you know, how to be cautious, how to keep your other software up to date, antivirus, you know, anti-spyware, firewall, all of the other things that you need to do security-related on your computer, it's not really all that likely that your computer is going to be compromised, but risk is not zero. So when you start talking about threat and risk assessments, you have to decide, first off, what is the likelihood of getting compromised? In this case, I'd say for most people, the likelihood is probably fairly low. Okay. Then you have to look at the consequences of what will happen if your computer is compromised. And that could be quite high. You know, it could be that your entire computer is taken over. It's used to attack other people on the internet. It's used to deliver spam. Somebody gets a hold of all your files, can get your credit card information, your logons for other accounts, things like that. So the consequences can be quite high. So you have to do that threat and risk assessment once you get beyond the point of not getting security updates for your computer. My advice, generally speaking, is you should not be using an operating system that is not supported by the vendor from a security point of view. You should move on. But you've got quite a while before you're into that position. You're talking another 2 years. So I think you don't have to rush, but you might want to plan it as just part of a general computer purchase that you will get Windows 10 on, you know, or something like that. What do you think, Alan?
I just use Linux.
You use Windows too, though.
I've always updated things when things are ready to update. I kind of a first adopter, I guess.
Yeah.
But I have an image backup, so I can always fall back if things go south.
Yeah.
And I did, as soon as Windows 10 came out, I updated my machine that was running Windows 8.1, I updated it to Windows 10, and it's run fine on Windows 10 ever since. It'll be interesting to see what happens after a while on Windows 10. I mean, how is Windows going to get any money out of this?
Well, they still sell licenses on new computers, so they definitely make money on that. So,
but there's not going to be a Windows 11, right?
Yeah, well, they'll continue to sell Windows 10 licenses on new computers. So.
Yeah. But support Windows 10 forever?
That's what they're claiming. Yeah. They said Windows 10 will be the last version of Windows. Now, eventually, your hardware will probably dictate that, you know, things are not working properly on it, you'll have to upgrade your hardware. And so if you buy new hardware, you're probably going to be buying a new licensed Windows with the new hardware. But
yeah. Okay, well, we're about, we're a few minutes over our hour, so I guess we'll start to wrap things up. But first of all, we'll ask if there are any other questions.
We have one going back a little bit. Let me just see if I can go back and find it. Yeah, from Claudette. Trying to connect to Google OneNote. I don't know about Google OneNote. Found out Gmail account has been blocked from sign-on on the PC. That I would be worried about sorting that out. I currently have to use Microsoft OneNote, which is definitely not going to be the same as Google OneNote. Not sure how to proceed. It appears that I can merge the data. But I use Google on the other devices, and I'd like to keep using Google OneNote. Personally, I would try to sort out the problem that you've got with it being blocked for sign-on from your PC. So more details about that on a future Q&A, or if you Google some stuff about that, you might be able to find some sort of solutions that you can follow through to get it unblocked on your PC. Does anybody else have any idea about having been blocked from Google login on a particular computer?
Okay. Chris, it's Corrine. It depends on when this happened, right? They had an outage or some kind of a mass outage of Google a few days ago.
I don't think, well, I suspect that's not the case in this case. Claudette, chime in if it was just within the last couple of days, but this seems like it was over a period of time because she's trying to use Microsoft OneNote, and I don't think this all would have happened this week. So perhaps some more information, Claudette, might help out probably for a future. If you send in the suggestion box, at opcug.ca, and we can make sure that it's first up next week. Claudette says, should I be very concerned if my email account has been owned after changing my password? Yes. Well, if it has been, you changed your password and then it was pwned, I'd be concerned. One of the biggest risks with email accounts being compromised is a lot of websites where you log on and you say, oh, I forgot my password, and they will send a password reset to your email address of record. If that email email account has been compromised, then somebody else could go on to, say, Facebook and say, I want a password reset, and that gets sent to that email address that they now have control over. So then they have control over your other accounts. So I'd be very, very concerned about accounts being pwned. If you can get in and change your password, then you're probably okay going forward on that. Make sure that you change your, if there are security questions, especially security questions that can be guessed what the answer is, like what's my favorite food, and they can go on and they can see, you know, you've been posting on Instagram of having pizza every day. They might guess pizza is your favorite food. So change your security questions as well. But if you can get in and change your password, you know, you're probably okay at that point in time, probably.
Okay, there are a couple of other questions. Well, yeah, questions, I guess, about different operating systems. I don't know if they want to go at those now or leave them until next week. Windows 10X and Windows Core modules.
Yeah, I think that we're running over 8 minutes late at this point, so perhaps we should leave that until next
okay.
week.
Right.
So if you can, anybody who's asked something that hasn't been answered, please send it into suggestion box at opcug.ca. We'll make sure it's in the queue for next week.
Okay, and two final slides. The next week's Tech Cafe, Monday at 10 a.m., is our good buddy, this guy, Chris Taylor. How to buy a digital camera. So if you're a Christmas present, Chris will tell you all you need to know about digital cameras, I guess. And, you have to register for that, because the library will send you the logon credentials. So you need to register if you want to attend the session. And the sessions are on our website too, so you can check on that. And then finally, the next Q&A will be next week, just before Christmas. So send all your questions to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. And we'll see everyone next week. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for attending.
Thank you all. Great job.